Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Today's guest is almost always the funniest person on screen, especially when she's playing Kelly on HBO's Insecure.
Girl, did he hit you?
What?
No. Okay, I like Lawrence, but I will go ape on that nigga. Okay, does he have a car?
Kelly.
I know he has a car. You know what? I'm going to fuck that up first.
He did not hit me. Okay, we're just going through this like really rough patch.
You're pregnant. I knew it. I bet Tiffany you would slip up. And as much as I need that $100, I'm not trying to.
I'm not pregnant. Okay? And you know what? I'm tripping. It's fine. I don't even trip.
Now, why you get me all upset? For no reason.
I'm sorry for making this about me.
Yeah, make it about it's my birthday.
Yeah.
It'll be about you if you get hit or have a baby.
Do you listen to yourself?
All the time. I have a podcast.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and that was Natasha Rothwell chopping it up with Issa Rae on season one of Insecure. That show is now in the middle of its fifth and final season, so I could not be more excited to have Natasha on this week's episode talk about that wild journey coming to an end and all of the other incredible things going on with her right now. This past year has been a big one for Natasha, who also co-starred in my favorite show of 2021, The White Lotus, as Belinda, the spa manager who ended up in a seriously dysfunctional relationship with Jennifer Coolidge's Tanya. We had such a great conversation about those two shows, as well as the early days of her comedy career, including how she ended up writing for Saturday Night Live and why she left after just one season. I think you're really going to enjoy this one. So here's me with Natasha Rothwell. Hey, how's it going?
It's good. Nice to meet you, Matt. I'm Natasha.
You too. So great to meet you. Are you still in London for working on Wonka?
That's right. Chocolate fun times.
How's that going?
Good. Yeah, it's my first sort of international travel. Mid-pandemic, post-pandemic,
yeah,
pandemic-ish.
I don't buy the post-pandemic thing when people say that. It doesn't ring quite true yet.
Nah, it doesn't either. So we have this phase of the pandemic. Maybe that feels better.
So yeah, welcome. I've really been enjoying watching this final season of Insecure. It's wild that it's finally ending. How are you feeling about it?
It still hasn't quite settled in. Yeah, I'm in what they call the denial phase of grief.
Yeah.
I probably really won't accept it to be true until the finale airs, but it's been quite the ride, and that's not just this season. I think the series itself, it's been such an amazing journey. So I'm excited to be sort of living these final moments with the audience and fans at home. It feels right.
I've been such a big fan of your character on the show for so long. I think I don't know if you know this, but I put your performance on our annual list of funniest performances. I think it was the Coachella year, because that episode just killed me. And I know it's one you probably hear about a lot, but that was a special one.
It really was. It was such a joy to do. And Millicent, our director, was just phenomenal. I think like just all of the moments of playing high and getting tased, it was such a beast of an episode. And it was just fun. It was fun to do with the girls.
Did you actually film at Coachella? How did that work?
We were in a giant field in the valley. So
okay.
No.
it was very convincing.
It was wild. I mean, this was obviously pre-pandemic time. So we had, easily 300 extras. And we had, a lot of the Coachella main staples replicated, pretty well on this farm. And then obviously computers and things came in to support, but yeah, a lot of people thought we went.
You actually
I was
went.
Like,
I know. I was like, I hope you really got to see Beyonce.
I know. If only that were true. If only that were true, but it was so much fun.
Why do the whites get to stay? Huh? I know why. Cause they're white, 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 and white.
Hey Kelly, we should probably just go.
Oh,
going back to the beginning of the show, I mean, how did this part of Kelly come to you in the first place? Because I know you're also a writer on the show. Did you start as a writer and then come on as cast? Or was it always that you were going to do both? Or how did it work?
No, I was hired to write on the show and planned to do just that. I got into the writer's room and was so focused on the writing bit. Because it was my first, you know, scripted television series I've ever worked on. And so I knew I had a lot to learn, and I wanted to, you know, to pay my dues, cut my teeth, and really sort of keep my eyes forward. And Kelly was generated out of the room as a character, courtesy of one of my dear friends, Ben Dugan, who's a writer as well. He was just like, you know, Issa's friend circle needs that friend. And so Kelly was created. And as a part of our process in the writer's room, we read all of the scripts aloud, just because, you know, it's the best way to make your work better. And so Issa would assign different writers to read different characters. So one week, you know, I'm reading Lawrence, and the other week I'm reading Kelly. And then the other week I'm reading Kelly. And then the other week I'm reading Kelly. And so it was after I kept reading her, I was called into Issa and Prentice's office, our showrunner. And they said, you're playing Kelly. Like, we want you to play Kelly. And I burst into tears because it was not even on my radar to even audition. I was so scared of, you know, being out of pocket. I was just like, I wouldn't even have asked for an audition, honestly. And so when it came to me, I was just so relieved that, you know, I couldn't hide all of the aspects of who I am. And Issa was just like, you know, you just saw your Netflix special, like, you're an actor, like, what are you doing?
Yeah. So, yeah.
You're just like, why are you trying to hide this bit about you? So that's how it came to be.
Yeah, I mean, I know you've said that you're not actually that much like Kelly in real life, but there must be some of you in there if they saw you for that role, right?
Well, I think the way my approach to acting, I think we possess all of the potential of human emotion, and we possess it all, but it's at different levels, right? So like, my potential to party exists within me, but it's normally at like a one, and Kelly's is like at a nine. So for me, it's not necessarily turning into someone that I'm not when I play Kelly. I just calibrate the dials. You know, I turn the party in me up. I turn, you know, their reverence in me up. I turn up the confidence, you know, the self-possessed assuredness that she has all the way up. And I think that is the joy, I think, of acting for me, is to be able to tap into those aspects that are me, but at levels I'm not normally accustomed. And I think over the course of the series, some of those dials have gone up and kind of stayed up, which has been really fun, of just having her rub off on me in terms of, you know, confidence and, you know, her ability to speak her mind and not doubt her enoughness. I feel like living in her space has definitely sort of allowed me to recalibrate those things in myself that needed to be.
Yeah. It's actually made you more confident playing her.
Oh, 100%. 100%. I think that I'm very much an extroverted introvert, and that remains the same. But I think being able to go out and authentically not care what people think, in a way that, you know, I think that has been such a revelation, because I'm, you know, Kelly is Miss, you know, give zero fucks, and I give all of the fucks. I care so much.
Really?
About everyone. Is everyone okay? Is everyone, you know, like, what do they think? And just my anxiety makes that an easy go-to for me. And so to relax into who I am as an adult 6 years later, you know, being this character, it's like, oh, okay, I can actually make the conscious choice to let go of some of that fear and anxiety and just be confident in who I am and what I've done. So I'm grateful to her for that, for sure.
Another favorite storyline of mine is the fake British accent, which I feel like you must be getting some use out of that now that you're in London. Are you slipping into it from time to time? Or
it is. I have to make a conscious effort to not, because and I think it's also kind of a byproduct of being an Air Force brat. Like, I moved around a ton in, you know, two high schools, two middle schools, two elementary schools, and I just very quickly, when you're, you know, a young kid reacclimating to an environment, you know, when we're children, we learn through mimicking. And so even from a young age, it would just be like, oh, this is how you guys sound here. I just came from Florida. This is Illinois. And then like, oh, I'm living in Toronto. So I'm such a quick study and I do it so often that I sometimes don't even know that I'm doing it. And it's just so, because I love the British accent so much. So it's also just, I'm very much an Anglophile. So it's very hard for me not to be, you know, chatting with, you know, Jim Carter on set. And I'm just like, I'm literally across from Mr. Downton Abbey.
Yeah, himself. You are in Downton Abbey.
I'm in Downton Abbey and I love it. I'm trying to collect, you know, some British slang to try out when I get back. Mm.
But, anything we'll good you've heard so far?
Oh, man. I just learned one earlier today, but I've already forgotten it. It's a shame, but I, being an Ender, like one of the West End, East End, just like what that means. I'm excited to frustrate and annoy my friends with my version of Madonna accent when I get back.
This is so nice. I used to be like, she wants to do what? Why? Where? How? And for what purpose? And then again, why?
Yeah, I was there. I'm just glad you always believed in me.
Oh, I've always believed in you, love. You've got that American entrepreneurial spirit.
What are you doing?
My new beau, Darnell, is showing me Los Angeles.
I faked an accent when we met, and now I have to commit.
Don't make it weird. Darnell, darling!
How you doing?
Please meet my dear friend, Issa D.
Nice to meet you.
Hello!
Hey, I'm American. Kelly's British.
So that is a fact. What do you call those?
Tacos.
A taco. That is so cute.
So you mentioned your Netflix special, which I think is the first time that I saw you in anything was in The Characters, which was this really unique and incredible project that I think it was 8 different comedians. You can explain how it worked, but they basically just gave 8 different comedians a half hour to do whatever you wanted on screen. Is that right?
That is exactly right. I think it was terrifying because I was just coming off of Saturday Night Live, and which
you were a writer on the show, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I was a writer on the show. And I remember walking into the office at the Netflix office and wanting so desperately to sort of please. And I'm just like, okay, so tell me what you guys want this half hour to look like. I'll make it my own. And literally sliding a blank piece of paper across the table, kid you not, to emphasize the point. And I was just like, and she's like, yeah, whatever you want to do. Like, we love your work. We want you to feel like you have full creative control. You're an executive producer. I was in the edit. Like, I really could do whatever I wanted. And so to go from, pretty specific expectations from SNL to just being able to do what made me laugh and what I found interesting and funny to this day, I mean, just one of the most freeing experiences creatively I could have ever had.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, but kind of daunting too, right? I mean, when you have no restrictions, no parameters, how do you go about deciding what you want that to be?
That's the right question. That's what I was asking myself. And I think that it was not dissimilar to my journey on SNL as a writer, because, you know, my first month or so there, I was just desperately trying to write sketches that I thought would make the air. And then I, you know, was not getting anywhere. And it was one of those things where it's just like, oh, they hired me for my packet, which is me writing just what I thought was funny. And so I made a very quick pivot of just like, okay, I'm no longer going to try to sort of write and do something in an effort to please someone else. I want to write and do what makes me happy. And that's when I started getting sketches on the air. And it really changed my perspective on my understanding of my own comedic voice, of just like, what is my comedic voice devoid of any input? Like, what do I want to say? And so coming off of the SNL with those questions already being asked of myself, when I did get that blank piece of paper in front of me, my natural inclination to people please popped up, and I was like, no, okay, what do I want to do? And for me, I love subversive comedy. I love levity and gravity. I love being able to play with interconnected characters and worlds, because I feel that feels very much like real life, where you're just, and again, because I moved around so much, it's like, oh, these people are like these people, and there's on this very same day, this experience is happening. And so I wanted to play with that kind
Sorry,
of.
Did you say that again?
Oh, my watch is trying to get on my interview. My watch needs to get out. But no, it was important for me to play with that interconnectivity. And I just tried to go from there as sort of like my cornerstone of just like my true north of my is what is my comedic taste? What is it that I'm drawn to? How do I create worlds and characters that can replicate that feeling I get when I see something that really speaks to me? So I'm really grateful, super grateful for Netflix for giving me that chance.
All right, what's wrong with you, baby girl?
Well, like I was just saying, I went camping this past weekend at Big Bear Lake, and I woke up covered in these itchy bumps. Okay. I think it's like poison ivy or something.
All right, well, put your arm right under here, and we're going to get a closer look, okay? Oh, that's not poison ivy. You were bitten by chiggers.
Excuse me?
You were bitten by little tiny insects called chiggers.
That's rough.
Yeah, and you still got a couple on you now.
Oh, no. Should I be worried?
No, it's just two. Now, if it were a group of chiggers,
I'd call the police.
Yeah, it's interesting, the dichotomy between that and SNL. I mean, you auditioned for SNL, right, to be on the cast, and then ended up as a writer. Sort of the opposite of Insecure, I guess.
Yes, very much.
You were part of that big search for a Black female cast member, which was this big controversy, you know, that people might remember from now almost 10 years ago. And what was your reaction to that at the time when you realized sort of what was happening and that they were doing these auditions of only Black women? Was that did you view that as a good thing, as a step forward, or was it a kind of, it seems complicated.
I feel like, the sort of realization happened when I showed up to the theater and saw the other folks auditioning. I was like, oh, it's all Black people. I was like, okay, I see what's going on. But obviously I'd read the articles prior to, and I think at the time, like you said, 10 years ago, it was definitely a necessary step. I think it's a historically white institution that didn't reflect the world we live in. And so I thought it was super important that they make a deliberate effort and a conscious choice to speak to that deficit. And I think that huge credit to, you know, Keenan and Jay to say, you know, we're not going to do drag because there are funny women out there. And I think that took courage for them to do. And I think that the writer's rooms, the sets, the crews that are inclusive, that's a deliberate choice. And I think that it became very clear to me that the effort that SNL made, as, you know, clunky as it may have been, I think it spoke to the need for other institutions to audit what their shows look like and what their rooms look like and make deliberate, conscious choices to, you know, diversify and have sort of like their baseline be inclusive, you know, casting and hiring.
Yeah. I mean, and then, you know, at a certain point, you must have found out that you weren't going to be in the cast, but they did want you as a writer. So how did you take that news? Were you excited to go be there and write on the show?
I was shocked for sure. I think for me, what is interesting about my journey is that SNL was never on my vision board as something that I wanted, by and large, because I didn't see myself reflected in the cast. And it was just like, well, I want to have a career in comedy. And there are many people who have figured that path out outside of Saturday Night Live. And so I felt that way before the opportunity presented itself. And so then when the opportunity did present itself, it was kind of like, oh, this is like, I think the enormity of what it was and what it meant to my white contemporaries was just different because they had, you know, Gilda, and I did too. I mean, I love Gilda. I mean, I watched the show, obviously, but they were looking at her and the mental gymnastics to project themselves onto her weren't as sort of involved as mine. And so I think to then go from not having it in my crosshairs to then having it in my crosshairs and then to be rejected by the guy you weren't even checking for to begin with, that role, I was just like, what? I was like, yeah. I wasn't even, you asked me out. What's
yeah,
going
yeah,
on?
Yeah.
And then again, to get the call a month later, they were just like, you know, you had one of the best written auditions and we would love to sort of meet with you to see about writing. And again, was like nothing that ever was in my purview. Just like, this is something that I wanted. And then became something that I very much wanted because I think for me, it was almost as important to me to have that representation reflected in the writer's room. If they're going to really do the work and have inclusion be not just, you know, visual tokenism, they needed to have writers in the room that looked like the casts that they hired. And so it was really a wild experience to sort of ride the the roller coaster there. But I learned a ton in the process, so I'm super grateful.
Was there anything that you were able to get on in terms of sketches that you were really proud of? Or because I know you said it was kind of a struggle to get stuff on the show.
Yeah, I think, you know, I got quite a bit on there in the end. But I think my proudest moment was doing, I wrote the monologue for Taraji P. Henson by myself. And it was like a big gospel number called I Made It. And it's, you know, she talks about what her career could have been, but I made it. Thank God I made it. I could have been this, but I made it. And it was a real big swing. I kind of like, you know, the culture of the writer's room there is, you know, when you're working overnight, you kind of sort of write with other writers and you're sort of connecting and trying to sort of like, well, we'll write the sketch together. And it was one of those nights where I was just like, I don't think anyone else is going to get this because it's very much in the diaspora of like Black American culture of just like a gospel song and a testimony. And so I just wrote it. And I remember Taraji performed the shit out of it at the table read. And I was just like, don't cry, Natasha, don't cry. You're like, don't cry. Doesn't mean it's going to get on. Don't cry. And the head writers at the time came over to me and just like really congratulated me. It was just like, it was a real big sort of relief. And I just am so grateful for Taraji to believe in it and me at the time. Yeah.
I mean, I spent so many years hustling in this business and now I'm here. So I guess you could say I made it. Hallelujah.
Don't worry about where you are. Be grateful that you've come this far. You may not always come in first. Just remember that it could be worse. I could have been a hip hop video ho. Did it once or twice, but not no more. None of that stuff matters now, cause I made it. Oh, yes, you made it.
And then, you know, obviously you only stayed there for one season. Was that your decision to leave after one season, or how did you?
No, I was not renewed, but I think in that I was also sort of writing my Netflix special at the same time. And it was during a hiatus. So it was very much serendipitous because it was just like, oh, had that actually gone through, I couldn't have gone through with the Netflix special, which put me on Prentice's and Issa's radar to take the meeting. And so I think things happen as they should. I think at the time when it's something that you want and you want to, I think I'll speak in I's instead of you's. For me, I wanted to get good. And I felt like for me, that was more the grief of it, of just like, oh, it's like by the end of the season one, you're just like, oh, I get it. You know, like, I know what this is. I know how to do this. And so it was almost
probably takes that long to become even a shred of comfortable.
100%. 100%. So, and you know, several of the writers and, you know, head writers had reached out after they had made decisions and were just super excited for me. And then I think that's when I realized, I was like, oh, like, this is the beginning of something, not the end of something. And especially when you look at the the roster of folks that have, you know, only spent one tour of duty at SNL, I'm in very good company. So it was an exciting time.
Coming up, Natasha talks about her brilliant performance in The White Lotus and the big ways that her character changed after she landed the part.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This episode of The Last Laugh is brought to you by Vanderpump Villa, a new reality show starring Lisa Vanderpump, now streaming only on Hulu. Join Lisa and her hand-selected staff at Chateau Rosabelle, a glamorous estate in the French countryside. Meet the elite staff as they work, live, and play together 24/7 while dealing with rivalry, romance, and misadventures. As they try to provide once-in-a-lifetime experiences for their guests, the staff will need to meet Lisa's high standards. Not everybody has what it takes. Watch new episodes of Vanderpump Villa every Monday, now on Hulu. If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. Check out our conversation with Natasha's Insecure co-star Amanda Seals, as well as episodes with other UCB alums like Nick Kroll and Abby Jacobson. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to those episodes and everything else from our free archive, and you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Natasha Rothwell. Well, we have to talk about The White Lotus, which was just one of my absolute favorite shows of this past year. And I think you're phenomenal in it.
Thank you.
I think for anyone who has just seen you on Insecure, where you're really, you know, most of what you're doing is comic relief, or in your sketch work and stuff like that, you know, it was really surprising to see you in this really nuanced, dramatic performance, even in a show that is also very funny and you have funny moments. But, what was that challenge like to take on this something very tonally different, I think, from other stuff that you've done?
Yeah, I mean, I think I found that aspect of people's surprise so shocking, but it's also, of course, because they didn't go to drama school with me.
Yeah,
so,
right?
Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm classically trained, and I've, you know, by and large, did a ton of drama and musicals and things in school that are so antithetical to Kelly and, like, that world. And so a lot of people who, you know, didn't have the opportunity to meet me in person at a bar and be like, Kelly, and they see me like shrivel because I'm so introverted. Those people already knew I was not Kelly, but I feel like to a greater audience, it allowed people to see that Kelly is actually an acting choice
mm-hmm,
and
yeah.
not just an extension of who I am. And I really enjoyed getting back to sort of, you know, they say dance with the one that brung ya. And so to dig into a dramatic role in a story that was so nuanced and layered, and where I played the straight man in the scenes against Jennifer. And I think that for me, it was such a fun role for that reason, to be able to sort of let go of the pressure and obligation of funny. And because I do take it very seriously, I take drama and comedy very seriously. And so it was sort of putting down those expectations and picking up a new set that I haven't been able to play with in front of an audience in a long time.
Yeah. Most of your scenes are with Jennifer Coolidge, who is also just incredible in the show. Were you a big fan of hers? And was that intimidating at all to go head to head with her in these kind of very awkward scenes in a lot of ways?
Yeah. I mean, such a huge fan, and I wish I could go back and sort of send a message to my younger self and be like, you're going to be playing opposite Stifler's mom. Don't freak out. Get ready. But she's such a delight as a human and is such a force on camera as well. And I think that it is very exciting to any actor, I think, to play against someone in which it feels like a game of tennis, where it's just like you're able to give it and give it in a way that feels cathartic. Because the opposite is, you know, playing tennis with drapes and it's just, okay, that didn't land. I think I'll pick it all, you know. So a lot more exhausting. And so it was just such a joy to get to know her as a person and to get to know Tanya through her.
What I'm hearing is you're having a lot of fatigue.
Yeah. I feel like taking a nap right now.
Why do you think you're so tired?
I think it's because I'm so close to the floor.
In general.
Well, my mom passed away in June.
I'm so sorry.
Just dealing with all of the logistics, you know, of it all, it was just exhausting. And I'm still dealing with it. You know, my mother, I have her ashes, you know. I brought them here and I was, you know, I was going to scatter them in the ocean because she loved the ocean. But I know I don't even know where I'm going to scatter them.
We shot in an NBA style bubble where we were not allowed to leave the campus of the Four Seasons Maui, which sounds very like, well, boo-hoo for you, but it was shut down. So we did not have the luxuries that come with.
You weren't hanging out by the pool and the...
No, we had no cabana boys, but we had each other. And so we had a lot of fun dinners and got to know each other. And yeah, I'm really grateful for the experience.
I was fascinated to learn that the role of Belinda was actually written for there was supposed to be a gay white man playing the role, and then you got cast in it, right? Is that true?
No.
Oh, I read that somewhere. Maybe that's I've got some bad information. It was did you see that? There was some big article that talked about that. Is that's not true?
No, it's not. I mentioned in an article that, and it's so funny. I was talking about this earlier. I'd mentioned in an article that it wasn't written expressly for a woman of color, but that doesn't mean that it was written for any color. It just wasn't.
It just was sort of written.
It was a character.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
and I think that what I find so interesting is that people took that to mean, well, if it wasn't expressly written black, it's obviously it was written for a white actor. And I think that is a lot of reason why castings look the way they do when they don't have to. But yeah, I think on the page, there was no, her name is Belinda and she was referenced with the pronouns she, I knew it was a woman, but there was no, sort of other identity attached to her. But when you have someone, or character without sort of cultural identity baked into the role, when you cast it, then that's inherently put on it. And so by being cast as Belinda, it changes the words on the page when you have someone who looks like me in a servile position in a mostly homogenous environment. And so it elevates the language and makes some things really subtextual that were text and conversely things that were text subtextual. So it was really cool to sort of discover who she is once I would put her on. And a lot of that sort of process of understanding who she is and her function in the show was born out of conversations I had with Mike. You know, even before I said yes to the character, I was like, let me talk to this guy because it means something for someone who looks like me to be playing this. Let's have the conversation. And he was so on board and so supportive and was just an amazing sort of partner in sort of building who she is.
What were those things that you wanted to make sure that were there, you know, with the character in those conversations with Mike White?
Well, yeah, I think my biggest fear is that you have a character, like I said, a woman of color in a servile position, the tropes and the potential pitfalls of tropes were there and not on the page. What I mean is just like in the perception of just my playing the part. And so I wanted to get ahead of that and sort of my approach and really giving her moments where we could see her agency, and that she's not just, you know, the magical Negro there to solve, you know, Tanya's problems, but that she has a passion for, you know, mental health and physical health and spiritual health. And that's a part of who she is, and grounding her wants and needs and showing sort of the emotional effect when those are denied, showing her sort of empathetic connection to Tanya allows us to see her as a character and not a caricature. And I think that when presented with a role like this, that's why I, you know, jumped at the chance to be able to subvert those expectations, where you see someone, you know, working at a resort, one of the only sort of Black people that you see, and yet her agency and control is present, even though she can't put words to it always. And we see that she has an empathetic lens when it comes to Tanya. So it doesn't come from just, well, of course she wants to go on a boat ride and bury her mom's ashes and, you know, put her mom, like, it doesn't, we don't just have that moment without supporting it with that emotional connection that they had during her first massage. And so we get to see sort of the empathetic reasons of her why. Whereas I think in the sort of, you know, tropey caricature roles that are of this ilk, don't have the why. It's just assumed that their why is because they're less than, or they don't deserve to have dreams or aspire. And I think in that sort of nuance that, you know, Mike brilliantly found with Belinda, it allowed her to be this multifaceted, nuanced character in a role that is familiar. And I think juxtaposing those things is what really sets it apart and made me say yes.
Yeah. One of those moments of agency that you mentioned, I think, is that eye roll that you give to Rachel in the finale. Was that something that was on the page or something that you just did in the moment? Or what were you trying to communicate with that?
Yeah, there was nothing on the page in that moment. But I think as, you know, walking through the world as a Black woman, there are masks that we have to wear. And I think it is an expression of, you know, class and privilege to not have to do that. And I think, you know, that is a moment where we see Belinda's mask down, where she's just unable to hide how she's really feeling. And I think for the audience, they're perceptive. And I think some would argue, well, we kind of know what she's feeling the whole time. But when you are living your life from a place of privilege, you don't see it. So in that moment, Rachel is so self-absorbed and unable to see anything outside of herself in that moment, that it's one of those times where, you know, oh, if she can't see it, I need to say it, because I'm not going to, I don't have it in me to sit through this. And so that's when she's just like, you want my advice? I'm done. Mm-hmm. I'm done.
Yeah.
And so, I think that it was just sort of a well-earned moment for Belinda, for sure.
Could I live with myself if I made this Faustian bargain where I just ended up being someone's arm candy for the rest of my life? You want my advice? Well, I'm all out.
I have to ask you about the envelope of cash that Tanya gives Belinda at the end, because I feel like that could either be seen as a gift or an insult, depending on your perspective. And I'm curious how you viewed it as the character.
It doesn't have to be one or the other. I think it's both.
Yeah.
It's an insulting gift. You know, I think it is less than what she was promised and not enough to do what she wants to do. And of course she takes it. Some people, it's so interesting that, you know, social media people are just like, you know, did she take it? You know, how much was in that envelope? Like, what's going on? You know, like, and even I had conversations with Mike and the props department, because the envelope was really much thicker than it was in the tape. And I was just like, if it's too thick, it's going to suggest that she made good on her promise. And we want to make sure that's not happened.
That's definitely not how I took it.
Oh, good, good, good. But I think it's both insulting and I think it's a gift. And I think it's painful for Belinda to take it, because she needs it. And I think that there's sort of a lot of blood swallowed in that moment, because she can't just push the envelope back and say, go fuck yourself. Because, you know, Tanya might be back at, you know, the White Lotus again, and she has to smile and go to dinner. And so there's a lot of obligation attached to, you know, privilege and class. And I think that in that moment, she was obliged to take it.
It seems like there's going to be more seasons or another season, but maybe in a different setting with a different cast. Is it something that you could be involved in, or do you know that you're definitely not going to be involved in? Or
I don't know. I know I'm Jon Snow. I know nothing. I know it was announced that there's a season two, which is super exciting. And I honestly can't wait to watch. And I know Jennifer's going to be in that. That was announced as well. But again, I'm so far away from the epicenter of decision making, but I love Mike and I love the crew and the cast so much. And I mean, if Belinda ever circled back around, I'd jump at the opportunity, but I don't think that's the plan. But I think just the opportunity to explore these dynamics in another location, I think, is exciting. So I'm tuning in.
I mean, between this and Insecure, you know, you obviously have been doing a lot with HBO. I saw that you were at some point developing your own show with HBO. Is that still in the works, or is there something that we can look forward to there?
We have two shows in development at HBO, which is super exciting. And more to come on that soon.
Yeah.
there's with these things, it's always kind of like you can't even talk about it until it's already aired kind of thing. But I'm really excited about those two projects. And then I also recently signed a deal at Disney, ABC Disney, that huge family, which is super exciting. And I'm working on a show to come there as well. And so I got a lot going on. I'm just trying to make the most of this moment. And I'm just so grateful to be in this position. So it's exciting to see what's next.
So before we get to the end here, I want to do our speed round, which is called the first laugh. So I'm going to ask you about some firsts in your comedy career.
Ooh, okay.
So let's start way back. The first piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard as a kid growing up, what's something that you remember just really, really making you laugh early on?
Oh man. I mean, there's so many, but what just came to mind was Sinbad. I remember he has a bit in one of his early stand-ups of his dog growing up was really sick and just wanted to kill itself. And so he just did an impression of his dog who was on this armchair that couldn't run or any, that was just kind of had to stay there. And his grandmother would just listen to the TV too loud. And this dog was just like, kill me, please. And I was super young because, I mean, Sinbad is like, you know, clean comedy. So I was super young and my parents were like, well, you can watch this. There's no swear words in it. And I just, that every time I would just put in that little VHS, rewind, like fast forward to that moment. And he's just so animated of just like, oh,
he's great.
So good. So good.
Do you remember the first time that you knew that you were funny?
Ooh. Very young. I was always, I think I just, the exact moment, I'm one of four. So I have two sisters and a brother and we were a military family. And so we entertained ourselves endlessly, you know, long road trips from, you know, different places we lived. And, you know, I used comedy as currency in school because, you know, everyone loves the funny kid. And it's hard to pinpoint just one moment, but I would say just from a very, very young age, when I knew if I could do something to cause like a physical reaction in someone else and it was just words or action, like I was just obsessed with that power. So I fortunately/unfortunately for my parents figured that out very early.
We didn't get to talk too much about the very beginnings of your comedy career. I know you started at UCB and did stuff there. Do you remember the very first time you performed either improv or sketch in front of an audience and what that was like?
It actually happened when I was in college. I started improv in college with a group called Erasable Ink at University of Maryland. And there's something so magical about improv. And mind you, prior to that, you know, in high school, we did improv exercises, but this was my first time being a part of like a group. And we would play it. Our library was called McKeldin Library. And there was the steps and it was outdoors. And every Friday at 1 p.m. we would perform. And I just felt like a rock star. I was just like, and comedy nerds were populated in the audience. It wasn't like, you know, throngs and throngs of people, but I just loved not having a script and being intuitive and having a group of people where we would just be in this mind meld of anticipating what they were going to say and being on board with the games that, you know, came out in the scenes. And At the time, we were doing a mix of long form and short form, and quickly abandoned short form and just started doing long form. But I was with them for the time I was there. And it was just a way of storytelling that felt so organic and natural to me, and made sense of how I created, because I, you know, even before then, would always do what I then became to understand is just like improvising as I write, or just like talking things out loud. And I was like, oh, this is that in real time. So yeah, University of Maryland, the Kelvin Steps, we'll never forget it.
Do you have a particularly memorable audition story? Something that you either went well or didn't go well, or something that you got or didn't get? It could be anything.
Ooh, happened in high school. I was auditioning for The Music Man. No big deal. and I, to this day, singing terrifies me, but I love to do it. I was in a karaoke league for years. Like, I love the karaoke aspect because it's low stakes. So I clam up. And I say this in London as I'm shooting a musical, so don't tell the director. but it is, it's something that it gives, at the time, gave me great anxiety to the point where I didn't know how to work through it. And so I decided to learn my song in sign language, also by and large, because my best friend at the time was hearing impaired. And so I had already been learning ASL just for my own edification. And so I was just like, well, what's the practical use for this knowledge? If not with her, I'm going to learn this whole song in AFL. But my nerves did what they do and got the better of me. And halfway through, I wouldn't even say that's generous, a quarter of the way into the audition, I blanked on the signs, but my hands were in the air and I'd already been committed. So I just did what can best be described as an interpretive dance. it was so mortifying. And in high school, it's the kind of high school's audition where like, you have to leave through the lobby and all the other, like, you know, auditionees are waiting to go in. And I had left the stage and gone through, and I'm just in tears. And I got the chorus, which is very exciting. So yeah,
chorus is important, you know?
Chorus is important, but I can just see, that's the other thing too. I was looking at my director in her eyes, which she tell you not to do, but I was looking for a life raft. And so I was just kind of like, doing that, but thank God I didn't stop.
Do you have a story about meeting a comedy hero? Maybe the first time that you met someone who you really looked up to in the comedy world, and how it went.
Oh my goodness! The first time I met a comedy hero. I mean, being at SNL during season 40 was just an embarrassment of riches, as far as that's concerned. I'll tell you this anecdote. So the SNL 40th party is sort of like legendary and everyone's talked about it. I was there and I lived the tale.
I'm so jealous.
I still can't quite believe it's real, but they're pictures, so I know it happened. this is the party in which I physically ran into Prince, and that was not I will say that was not the highlight. The highlight was after that moment of physically running into Prince, I said I was an extroverted introvert. I like collapsed in on myself and was just like, okay, my only way to get through this night is to like grab a glass of champagne and go to the dance floor, because there was this pocket of just like non-celebrities where we were just kind of like, let's just listen to Questlove spin and
the,
just live
the non-celebrity section.
Yes. So I
which must have been like, pretty small. I mean, because it was mostly celebrities, right?
It was very small. So it was basically all of the freshman writers. We kind of just like, you know, got to the dance floor. And it's the kind of thing when you've been on a dance floor and you can sort of sense someone like dancing with you. And I was just like, you know, feeling the vibe. And I turn around and it's Bill Murray. And it's one of those things where I was just like, fuck it. And so we just kind of like danced with each other as Questlove is playing. And he's such a hero of mine. Like, not even just his body of work, but like, he doesn't even have like cell phones or agents. Like, he's just such a man unto himself. And he could tell that I was just like screaming with joy from my eyes. And after the dance, he sort of like patted me on the shoulder. I was like,
oh my God.
But he was just cool, because for him to be hanging out with like all of the like, you know, non-celebrities, being like, he was just not about that schmooziness. He was just like, I love this song, so I'm going to dance. And so we danced.
my big SNL 40 mystery that I've always been trying to solve is, what happened with Eddie Murphy? Because he was, he didn't perform comedy. He just kind of did a little short speech. And do you have any insight into what happened there?
Oh man, I was not in the room where it happened. I was definitely not in the room where it happened. My best guess, I mean, I honestly don't know. There was so that event of just the actual show and then the after party were just such massive productions. So I can't even begin to think of why that was the way it was, but I was just glad he was there. I got to see him in real life. And yeah, it was wild. That I physically bumped into Beyonce.
Oh my God.
Also, I literally laughed because I didn't know what to say to her. It was just a lot. It was the whole night was just like, there's these moments I'll have where I'm just like, Paris Hilton cut in front of me at the bar. That's crazy. Like, who's that? Or like, I went into this other ante room to like catch my breath. And it's just like Steve Martin and, you know, Eddie Murphy just chatting with their like family. And I was just like, this is a fever dream that I hope is real. But
yeah, I don't know how you top that.
You don't.
SNL 50. Maybe you can get the invite to that.
Maybe. We'll see.
Hopefully you'll be hosting by then.
Yeah, I would not say no. We'll see.
I would like to see it. So finally, before we go, I like to give comedians a chance to shout out other comedians or comedy that you're enjoying right now. So what's the last piece of comedy that really made you laugh that you want to shout out?
Ooh, I'm obsessed with Sex Education on Netflix.
So good. So good.
It is just... it's just great. And specifically, I think it was in this current season, episode 3, where Sex Killed the Cat. It's just smart and funny and necessary. I think just having like frank and honest discussions about sex. Well, I was a high school theater teacher in the Bronx for 4 years. So a huge part of my responsibility was like keeping kids off each other, like sexually, to be like, okay, keep it in your pants, go over there. And so I just appreciated that kind of just like open and honest conversation. And it's just funny and dark. So that made me laugh a ton. Inside Job, also on Netflix. I do a ton of animation. I think that's super smart and funny. Female driven and led, which is super smart. There's so much. I think that also is what is exciting about this moment in film and television is just the number of platforms just demand more content. And so more opportunities from different creators being able to produce and do things. So it's an exciting time, but excited about those things.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I'm just such a big fan of yours. And
thank you.
Good luck with Wonka. I hope you learn more British slang. I hope.
I do too, mate. I hope so.
Thank you so much. And good luck with everything. I'm excited to see all of those mysterious shows you have coming up.
Yes, I'm excited for you as well. Thank you so much. Take care.
All right. You too. Bye. All right. Thank you so much to Natasha Rothwell for joining me on today's show. You can catch new episodes of Insecure every Sunday night at 10 p.m. on HBO. And both that show and The White Lotus are available to stream on HBO Max. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next week on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.